Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. It's Bill and George for another award-winning episode of Amazing Talk of Recovery from Addiction of All Kinds. Tonight, we're going to be talking about opioids. And I'm looking at my friend and colleague, George Fraser, thinking, George, this is going to be an interesting show.
Well, I know who our guest is, and it will be. It'll be very interesting. One of my favorite speakers in 30 years of counseling, by far. You want to stay tuned to this show.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Dr. Holly Geyer is our guest. She's written a book called Ending the Crisis, Mayo Clinic's Guide to Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. That's really an amazing book, and it's going to bring a lot of light to this opioid crisis.
Well, a lot of problems, a lot of deaths, seems to be out of control, and we're looking for answers. And researchers like Holly is and doctors are going to lead us out of this. And it'll be a very interesting show. We've lost a lot of people that we know through overdoses, people we worked with.
Yeah, there's a story in her book, George. I'd like to go through parts of it because I do think it resonates with a lot of stories that we hear and people we know. And the story is about a woman. She was a writer, a great cook, a loving grandma. She worked hard, and she was very grateful for all the blessings. But in her 50s, starting in her late 50s, she was talking about what she had called to her kids a bum knee. I got a bum knee. You've heard that before, haven't you?
Sure.
And she said that her pain was probably caused by the family tradition or legacy of arthritis. And all of her kids tried to get her to get a knee replacement, but she wouldn't do it. So the pain got worse over the years, and she just asked her doctor for opioids, and they gave them to her. And they gave them, she got lots of them. And that didn't really go well because there were some pretty bad side effects that came as a result. One of them was she became horribly constipated, and she ended up having a bowel perforation followed by bowel perforation surgery. And there was complications from that, and she ended up dying. And she said it all goes back to those opioids. There's the starting point. And you say, I had a bum knee, and I got some opioids to reduce the pain, and it ended up probably causing her death.
Well, it happens a lot, Bill. And in the practice I used to have with a relapse group, I'd get guys that had 10, 15 years of sobriety, business leaders, going to accountability groups, leading Bible studies at church, going to get their knees scoped or some shoulder work on the rotator. They get oxys. They run out. They're buying heroin downtown because they miss the euphoria, the buzz, the escape. And it can happen to anybody, anywhere, at any time. The drugs are too good. And I believe they were started to get people out of pain, a good, you know, good idea. And I'm sure what Holly will talk about is that took a wrong turn.
Mm-hmm. George, when we talk in the news, like when the musician Prince died in 2016, he died of an opioid overdose. Apparently, he had some medication that was laced with fentanyl, had amounts of fentanyl in it. And he, I don't know if he was using it for pain relief or if it was for recreational reasons, because you can start with pain relief and then all of a sudden you start using it for
exactly
how it makes you feel, right?
Well, you don't want to go through the withdrawal, and
okay,
it hijacks your brain.
Yeah.
You remember Robert Palmer?
Yeah.
The lights are on, but you're not home.
Yeah.
Your will is not your own. Might as well face it. You're addicted to love. Might as well face it. You're addicted to a chemical.
Yeah. When you start to use language, though, like accidental overdose, when you hear those words, George, I think, well, if you're using recreational drugs and you're buying illegal recreational drugs and they happen to be laced with something dangerous like fentanyl, is it really an accidental overdose?
Sure.
Okay.
Here's why. So when I started using, back in the 1970s, cigarettes, marijuana, and harder drugs, there was never the risk of dying.
Yeah.
Now you don't know what you're going to get. And if fentanyl's in it, we've lost some friends this year, Bill, that bought crack and there was fentanyl in it, and they died. It's, at the time, if you're a user, it's an acceptable risk that'll never happen to you, and then it does. So people don't go out to kill themselves, but they achieve that anyway. So I wouldn't look at it as a planned overdose. It's a risk I'm willing to take.
Okay.
So it's an accident. That's what I would come down
on. Yeah. Just overdose.
It's a good question. But you're still dead.
I get it. You're dead. But just overdose would be, feel in my head, to be more appropriate. He died of an overdose versus an accidental overdose.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you're taking illegal drugs and you take too much and you die, you've overdosed.
Yeah.
You die of an overdose. The drugs killed your body.
And I would say most of the overdose are accidental.
Okay.
You know, I'm willing to take the risk. And addiction is really loss of control psychologically, physically, spiritually. Your will isn't your own. And you lose the power of choice. And one of the things we get with some abstinence and some detox is we can get that choice back. But we have to rebuild the life before we get that euphoric recall coming back. And we have to have a good reason to not do it. And most of it is my life is better, so much better without it. But that I don't see a lot of people getting off opioids. And addiction is a lifelong process. We're not cured. I'm shocked at how I still struggle with it well into my 30s of sobriety, 30 years of sobriety. But it's a gift from God, I believe. He is sovereign. He allowed it. It's like Paul's thorn in the flesh. I have to humble myself and walk with my Creator every day, so it's really a gift. But getting to that point is hard.
Mm-hmm. If you have a loved one, or maybe yourself, you have recovered from using drugs like an opioid. George, talk about what it might be like if you have a period of sobriety and then you decide to return to using. Your body may not be ready to take on what you're putting in it.
Yeah, there's reverse tolerance with opioids. So very simply, if you're an alcoholic and you're drinking three beers, you go to six beers. Well, if you do that with opioids, heroin, oxy, it's a reverse tolerance. And if you stop a while, what you took the last time you used will kill you, can kill you very easily. And we're seeing a lot of bodies. So the big thing is, and I think I go, we do, you know, steps on this program. I always go to step one where we admit we're powerless, our life is unmanageable. And if you're using opioids and you're willing to take a risk, because it won't happen to you, of buying other drugs on the street now, you're taking risks that we didn't have before, Bill. People didn't die from doing a drug that normally wouldn't kill you, but it kills you now because there's fentanyl in it. And I don't know how you stop it. It's a big public policy thing. But it's gotten, in all my years of recovery and being a professional counselor, it's never been worse.
Mm-hmm. And our deep desire on Real Recovery is, first and foremost, that you come to a saving faith in Christ, that you place your faith and trust in Him.
Right. And I think when we look at that, I always want to have my eyes fixed eternally. So I don't want to help somebody get sober and not get saved. And I don't think just because you're sober, you're saved, because the Bible says, no, you're not saved by any other name other than Jesus, Acts 4:12. But I think a lot of Christian treatment centers that I've worked at feel that if you're saved, you're going to get sober. And that doesn't work either. Okay, you still have to walk out your faith every day, and you've really been given a gift that forces you to pray for sobriety right away in the morning. His mercies are new every morning, and we look at Matthew 6:34, don't worry about tomorrow, each day has enough trouble of its own. You walk out each day, and Jesus said you have to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a gift, but it's takes a long while to get to where you see it as a gift.
Yeah, but when you believe in Jesus and make Him your Lord and Savior, you have the Holy Spirit living in you, and for that first time, you have what I would call the restraining power of the Holy Spirit to give you strength and power over sin that you've never had before. So that doesn't mean you're going to instantly stay sober. It does mean, though, that you have a power you've never had before.
Yeah, and the reason I use the 12 steps is to empty George out of the inside of me so it can be filled with the Spirit.
Yeah.
And you have to do something. It's an effort. And I think sometimes on our recovery show when we have guests, it's kind of a people talk about they found Jesus and everything's wonderful. Not the experience for most people. Right. Okay. And Christianity is harder than not being a Christian. You got to work at it, but you have the gift to do it. And I think what we have to do is get out of God's way. And that's what the 12 steps do for a lot of people. They're ego deflating. Really, if you're an addict, that becomes your God. And if you're walking in addiction and not doing a thing about it, you're not doing what God wants you to do.
Mm-hmm. So if you are struggling tonight, we want to just come alongside you and love you exactly where you're at. And we would suggest, as always, that you give your life to Jesus and put your faith in him. You're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness you've never, ever known before. And you will never regret moving forward in the power of the Holy Spirit. And you will know peace, and you will have a new understanding of the Serenity Prayer, which is an amazing prayer. And no matter how far you've gone down this hole, God will help you get out.
You know, it is a great prayer, Bill, but it doesn't do you any good if you don't say it.
Yeah.
So you got to work it.
Yeah. Say that Serenity Prayer for me.
When I see you, I always say it. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah. All right. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We've got Dr. Holly Guyer as our guest tonight. We can hardly wait to bring her on. So we're going to take a short break and bring on Holly. We'll be right back. Welcome to Real Recovery. Getting to the topic at hand, George P. Fraser, there are a few things that are as painful as the loss of anyone to an opioid overdose, and families are left wondering what happened and what did we miss. And today we're going to have a chance to talk to Dr. Holly Guyer. She's written a book called Ending the Crisis, Mayo Clinic's Guide to Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. What are your thoughts?
Huge problem. When I used to have to go to continuing education unit classes, and I remember a doctor from St. Paul, Minnesota, who worked at St. Joe's Hospital, went up there one day and said, basically, people are not getting off opioids. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line truth. And I think it was less than 5% at that time, and it's a huge crisis. People are dying, so I can't wait to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, Dr. Holly Guyer's got a very impressive resume, George, and I'd read it, but it would take the next 12 minutes. So I'm just going to bring her on.
I've heard her speak. She's good.
Yeah,
really
she's amazing.
Good.
Holly, so glad to have you with us.
It is such a pleasure to be with both of you today.
Yeah, I really, she sounded like she meant it, George.
Yeah, probably had to practice that a little bit.
Well, <Yeah.
laughs> all in honest, I promise.
Yeah, and of course, we are very concerned, like so many others. I have a friend who lost a son to an opioid overdose. Who knows what was in it? And it's heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. And do we understand correctly how to manage opioids, how to use them, and how easily they're abused?
You know, Bill, welcome to 2023. When you know that you've got a friend who's lost their life to opioids, you join one out of every five Americans.
Wow.
This is truly an epidemic, and it's an ongoing crisis that's continued to worsen. We had 107,000 lives lost to the drug epidemic last year, and it's a good day to be talking about this because a new report came out literally this morning that's kind of being covered across the nation on how common polysubstance abuse or multiple drugs of abuse are now being combined with opioids, just rising these, skyrocketing these rates that we've been seeing. So you're not alone in this.
You know, it's very interesting. Bill and I lost a good friend this year on crack that had fentanyl in it. And you don't know what you're getting on the street anymore, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, right off the bat, we recognized through a report a couple of weeks ago that showed that a substantial number of pills that are coming through our country are tainted with fentanyl. Hmm. Somewhere between 40 to 60% of those, depending on the package that comes in, is enough fentanyl in one dose to kill a person. There is no wiggle room. It's not like you and I, I'm not going to date myself, but remember the kids from the 70s and 80s, you know, the kids would go out and experiment and parents would say that shame on you. Don't do it. You get grounded for a couple of days. It didn't threaten your life. This is a different day and age. One pill can kill is the DEA's new campaign. And I couldn't agree more with that statement.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Holly Geyer is our guest. Holly, maybe you would be nice enough to give us a little brief history of the opioid epidemic.
you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as once said, but the reality is the road to hell is often paved with cash. And that probably best describes what happened to our American opioid epidemic. If we go back into the 1980s or so, years prior to that, the concept of using prescription opioids for anything outside of huge traumatic pain or individuals with cancer was virtually unheard of. We in the medical community knew overwhelmingly opioids, no bueno. They can lead to addiction, especially when used illicitly. But there was this famous New England Journal of Medicine article that came out. And for our audience that aren't familiar with that journal, it is probably the premier medical journal in our country that we go to for great evidence-based medicine. And this article came out around the early 1980s. It was 5 lines in length. Think about that, 100 words. And someone had done a study, I loosely use the term, that looked back over their populations in a healthcare system. And out of about 11,000 patients, those that had gotten an opioid prescription were followed. And then they looked for any charting or evidence of opioid use disorder from those prescription medications for opioids. And they counted just a handful of them. And the last line of that article was essentially, we conclude that there's limited evidence to suggest that you can really become addicted to opioids. That article lit the nation on fire. It was recited more than 600 times over the next handful of years. And it became really a nidus along with many other publications that followed suit to say, listen, prescribed opioids are safe. In fact, we're probably under-treating pain. Mm. And then we see all these regulatory agencies and national societies jumping on the bandwagon saying, we're under-treating pain. Pain is the fifth vital sign. And by the way, the only subjective one, which should cause some concern, right? And then we start tying financial reimbursement to both medical institutions and to providers, right? We got to bring home the bacon too, based on how well patients think that we've satisfied their needs for pain control in a healthcare setting. And at the same time, there's regulatory requirements that every patient that walks through our doors has their pain assessed. So if I come in with a non-painful condition, you ask me what my pain is, and I know I want opioids, why not say 10 out of 10, right?
Right.
And that doctor's going to give it to me because they want their paycheck. It spiraled out of control. And then the icing on the cake is all of these fraudulent drug marketing campaigns. You know, they're pumping gas outside of the gas stations next to healthcare systems where they know doctors frequent just for the 3 to 5 minutes it takes to fill our fuel up, right? And they're telling us about their new drug. They do it for free. They fly us on elaborate trips overseas. They'll give us $25,000 per speaking engagement. You put this all together, and I would point fingers directly at the healthcare industry for really being the nidus of the opioid epidemic. But I think it's important to understand we weren't the only ones at play, and it's been multifactorial since then.
So you said the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and you're a doctor, and I respect doctors, you know, that to get the work to go through that. We did start off trying to get people out of pain that we couldn't. And it didn't work, and it went out of control, and money interests, and you know, you always trail that. But for a lot of doctors, they were really trying to do the right thing. Fair?
You know, we look back at the amount of time that the average physician gets education on pain in medical school prior to the mid-2010 era, and literally, it was managed in minutes for many medical schools. So we walked in with a poor understanding, and historically, with it being understood mostly as a symptom, not as a disease, we weren't prepared for what was about to come with this opioid epidemic. But at the same time, you know, I put it in the paradigm shift of diabetes. Any diabetic who walks into a physician's office is going to expect probably to get their medications, right? But they're going to get educated. They're going to be screened for comorbid diseases. They're going to be watched for any other, you know, multifactorial processes that can come out of diabetes diseases. And that's what we didn't do in this setting with opioids. We weren't educating our patients on the risks and the benefits and the alternatives. We weren't looking for risk factors for opioid use disorder, or better known as addiction. or for risk for overdoses. We weren't screening for addiction once people were on these medications. And when they did have evidence of addiction, we weren't referring to robust substance abuse treatment programs. We weren't offering naloxone, which is that opioid rescue medication. We didn't have internal policies on how to prescribe safely anyway. It was doc by doc. And then we didn't take the time to advocate in the community on the needs for everything I just listed. There was more we could have done, and there more probably the government could have done, the community, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies. It was all of us at once that really contributed.
So good. Dr. Holly Geyer is our guest tonight on Real Recovery. Holly, maybe you would give us an idea as to some of the more common signs of opioid abuse or misuse, because people have people, loved ones living with them, and they're starting to raise an eyebrow. How would we detect signs of abuse?
So one of the first things I would say is it can happen to anyone. I'll repeat that. Opioid use disorder can happen to anyone. According to the American Medical Association, between 3 and 19% of people who touch an opioid will develop dependency or addiction. That is not a small number. There are certain risk factors that can increase that risk. And so one of the first things I'd say is if you're looking at a loved one and you have some concerns, start wondering if they were a setup for this to begin with. Were there risk factors? And the big ones, any history of personal addiction. This includes simple stuff, right? Tobacco or alcohol. And it can be years ago that they had that. We've recognized that the rewiring or the neuroplasticity that drives addiction in the brain can be there for long term in many individuals. And so they're just a setup for problems down the road when we overexpose them to a medication that can rewire that brain again. The other things, if they have mental health disorders and other reasons to chemically cope, that can be a big one. And then if there's a family history of addiction, if they have chronic pain syndromes too, you put all those together and your antenna might want to go up for someone, especially to watch them more closely. The signs and symptoms you're going to want to look for in a loved one, though, I really think distill down to what we call the four C's of addiction. The four C's are cravings, and that's someone who starts thinking about this drug all day long, right? It's on the top of their mind. They're watching TV and it pops into their mind and they get up and they go look for the drug. It's someone who is being told that they need to start tapering down or look for other alternatives, and that drug craving just keeps hitting them, whether or not it's for pain control. The next C is control, the inability to stop, even if they wanted to. You know, this is someone that you have a family conversation with and you're saying, listen, you're not as functional while on the drugs as you used to be. And you don't seem to be able to stop. And despite these requests, they continue to go back to the drug, despite the next C, which is consequences. Life starts to fall apart. They're not as engaged in activities as they should be. They're neglecting life responsibilities. Their personality is changing. And then finally, the last C is compulsion, that inability to stop once they've started the sequence again, right? They can't stop thinking about it. They can't stop the activities associated with it. They're rewired to really go back to it. Now, this is not how we diagnose opioid use disorder. Opioid use disorder is done in a medical setting or by providers or professionals that are skilled to use something called DSM-5. That's a scoring criteria, and we would apply that to anyone whose family or personally feels that these four C's might be present.
So good. All right, Holly, we're going to take a little break. Dr. Holly Geyer is our guest. She's written a book called Ending the Crisis: Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. We're going to take a break and come back. You are listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We've got Ryan on the board. We'll be right back. We are back with Real Recovery, Bill and George. And during the break, I was talking to George, which isn't always the easiest thing to do during the break. It's not.
No, I get paid to talk to you. I can do it for an hour.
Sometimes it's a long 90 seconds.
It is.
I just got to be honest.
Yeah, you do.
But you were bringing something up I thought was very interesting, and I would like to bring this up and then let Holly comment on it as well. And that is some of the guys you have sponsored in recovery who are doing great. They've got lots of sobriety. Then all of a sudden they get their hip replaced or their shoulder done, and they get a little opioids for recovery, and boy, they're relapse, and they're off to the races.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was when I was running a relapse group with the, to get into it, Holly, you needed a previous year minimum of sobriety, and I would get a lot of guys who had 10, 15 years. They were going to accountability groups, church guys, executives. They'd get their knee done or their shoulder scope. They'd get Oxy, lights the scoreboard, the neuroplasticity we're talking about. When they would run out, they'd be downtown buying heroin off the street. Have you seen this a lot?
Oh, too much. I'll tell you what. Part of my other world is being a hospital internal medicine physician. And yesterday I held the pager for our division. And out of 16 patients that I brought into my service, three had that story, George. Three of them.
Wow.
I spent 20 minutes in the emergency room talking one guy off a cliff as he decided to leave against medical advice because his fear of this uncontrolled withdrawal symptom was the primary driver for getting out. I tell you, every one of those had the same story of starting off in the medical field, right? Legitimately getting opioids, having a normal lifestyle. These aren't people out there trying to chemically cope or look for, you know, alleviation of medical or, I'm sorry, anxiety or depression. They're people that we started on these drugs. And over time, just like you're talking about, that neuroplasticity that starts to rewire the brain in terms of how we experience the pleasure chemicals and then what parts of the brain can talk to each other starts to change. We recognize that between months to years, that rewiring can lay some pretty permanent imprints in individuals. And that's why the American Society of Addiction Medicine says that addiction is a chronic relapsing disorder. Not at all that it means that you have to live in that lifestyle of addiction, but it means that you're set up for problems down the road if we reactivate any of those systems that we can hopefully get dormant with enough therapies and treatment plans. Every time we put a car on something in the brain that was once a four-lane freeway in drug addiction that we've been able to turn back into a bike path, we just repave it into that four-lane freeway again with that drug. And so you're absolutely right. It's key that we're monitoring in the medical field anyone who goes back on an opioid or any other substance that can have dependency potential once they've had a history of addiction to anything else. It's a fascinating study that we're still learning from.
You know, I experienced this a couple of years ago. I had a heart ablation, and they gave me the stuff I think Michael Jackson died from, propofol or something like that. I'm not a doctor. And I've been sober a long time. And I had to call the next day my mentors and my buddies and go, I like this way too much. And my main mentor said, you're surprised as a recovering drug addict that you still like doing drugs? And I was like, yeah, duh, what a surprise. I got to tell you, it was wonderful. And I tried to stay awake as long as I could, you know. What is it, propofol? How do you pronounce that?
You named it propofol.
Oh.
Yeah, milk of amnesia, some call it. We've got a lot of drugs out there that in very particular populations, again, I go back to that 3 to 19%, they're going to experience some degree of euphoria with it. In the addiction field, they estimate that upwards of 50% of people that develop long-term drug dependency started off with some kind of a family or genetic component. And I'll tell you, George, we don't understand it to the degree that we would like to at all. And we can't use that experience to predict, from one family member to the next, who it's going to manifest in. But I will say we have some people who take an opioid and throw up for 3 hours or take a benzodiazepine like Xanax and feel out of it for 2 days and never touch it for the rest of their life. And there's others who say it only took one pill and I've been chasing that high ever since. We don't get it. But those who have a setup for that surge of dopamine seem to manifest it with other drugs of a potential abuse. So welcome to the club.
Okay. So didn't mean to interrupt you there, but is it possible then, is there any scientific proof that maybe addicts get a better buzz than normal people?
Oh, that's well established in many circumstances. But I think it's important to understand that the origins of drug addiction aren't the same for every person. We recognize three main groupings of individuals that enter into long-term drug dependency. And so we've talked about the first one, those that are overexposed to opioids with no prior history of any issues, right? They thought they were getting this legitimately from their doctor. And then the more and more exposure, the opioids start to rewire the brain, and then they find themselves in that lifestyle of not just dependency, but ultimately addiction. That That's just one group. But the next group are those that use this drug recreationally, and quite frankly, any drug. Those are the ones that we think of our teenagers falling into, or young adults who are going out, they're partying, they get that euphoria. And then the more and more they're exposed to the drugs, the more those drugs rewire the brain. And then ultimately, that's the population that ends up in long-term dependency too. And then that final group, those are the ones that recognize the intense pain, mental health pain alleviation that they get with opioids. This is someone going through a divorce, or like someone I admitted yesterday whose dog just died at 2 years old out of nowhere. It flopped over dead and he loved that puppy more than anything. And that one hit of fentanyl would help alleviate it. And he'd been on it for a month. But those roads all together are things we need to recognize, because we treat them a bit differently just depending on their experience and what brought them into this lifestyle.
Yeah. The divorce thing didn't get me, but the dog thing did. And you know, release is, you want to search for relief. I'm wondering about the neuroplasticity, if it changes that and people get into recovery, and we're a Christian show here. We look at Ephesians 3 about putting off the old and putting on the new. Can I, through exercise and other activities, maybe a worship, can I alter my neuroplasticity to get new pleasure centers so when I don't miss getting high from my drug?
Yes, yes, and yes. I am a big fan of the field of licensed counseling, because the word licensure comes with all sorts of standards that are ultimately employed in the field to demonstrate the scientific principles that guide them. When we think about drug and alcohol counseling, you know, oftentimes including motivational interviewing or other forms of cognitive behavioral therapy, there is data behind this to show that as these principles are employed, we rewire our brains. And that allows our brains to experience pleasure normally again. We've done scientific studies using neuroimaging, you know, stuff that lights up on actual MRI scans that prove these principles. And so, although I'm not familiar with Frank's studies that have looked directly at Christian or faith employed principles, I can say that that's just one more adjunctive approach that should be combined with the licensed counseling world to really get people back on track, so that normal activities, hugging your kids, eating ice cream, brings that euphoria on, and you don't have to turn to the drugs.
What about exercise, the natural opioids in your brain?
Oh, goodness. So you brought up an important point. We make our own opioids. They're called endogenous opioids, and that's why we have opioid receptors. Everyday pleasurable activities raise our opioids a small percentage, and those bind to the receptors in the brain that then release our happy chemical called dopamine. But there was a great rat study done a couple of years ago, and my goodness, those poor rats. So they took a rat and they fed it something happy, and the percent of normal output that should be happening in the brain went up 100% when that rat ate. And then it came down within 15, 20 minutes or so. But then they took those rats and they fed them methamphetamine. And you know what happened to the pleasure chemical? It went up 1,000%, and it was up for hours and hours. And they did the same thing with morphine, and it went up about 300-400%, and it was up for hours and hours. Now you can imagine what happens to the brain when it's exposed for hours to hours, day by day, year by year to these chemicals. Whole lot of brain changes. We can get a lot of this back by changing our lifestyle. But again, it's going to have to get us to a point where the small amount that our body produces, albeit through exercise or other activities, is enough to saturate the receptors and give us that pleasure sensation again.
Dynamite. That was so good.
I know.
The only way I'm able to stay sober, and I you go to accountability groups, I'm in the Word, I go to church, I pray for sobriety before I get out of bed. I started working out because I always missed getting high. It took me 7 years to get 1 year sober. And, yoga is like three drinks, swimming 2,500 yards is like four. And it works. And I think we're supposed to do that. You know, you look at Romans 12, is it, Bill? We offer our bodies a holy living sacrifice and worship to God. And you get those smaller pleasures instead of that big, gigantic leap, where the little contentment, you know, walking your dog, seeing your friends, is good enough to maintain recovery. But I think the reason most people go back, opioids, they don't want to go through the withdrawal. That's a negative. But they get into recovery and they miss the buzz, the euphoria, the peace, the escape. Fair?
George, you're hitting on something big that's emerging in the addiction literature and in our industry as a whole. We've recognized for a long time that people that chase pleasure, that dopamine surge, which all drugs of abuse offer, by the way, all drugs of abuse, is one of the primary reasons it's so hard to get people out. And I will say there's a lot of phenomenon within drug treatment programs that once someone has become abstinent from the drug of abuse and they go into long-term residential treatment, they start gaining weight, right, to tremendous degrees, or they change over to Red Bulls, or they go on roller coasters that take you 7 billion miles an hour. What are those people doing? Well, they're chasing a different high. And that's one of the things we're recognizing in this field. Not only is that dopamine system aberrant in populations who've used drugs of abuse, but so is the serotonin system. Serotonin is your rest, your relaxation, your cognition, your sleep, your emotional stability system. And what we want people to start doing is chasing the serotonin system, right? The stability of lifestyle, the taking pleasure in simply sitting and reading a book, the taking pleasure in going for two simple walks a day. All those things that cause the rest and relaxation lifestyle, as opposed to chasing the highs, is something I found many people who struggle with addiction difficult to achieve. And it should be a target, I think, now in every drug and alcohol treatment program.
How about watching hockey on TV? Does that count too?
It depends how bloody. Some of these are pretty boring.
I know you have a lot of background in recovery, and it seems to be over the field has shifted over the years to the quality of the recovery rather than stopping the drug. That people's recovery has to be better, more contentment, more fun, happier than using, because otherwise they go back. Fair?
Oh, it's so true. We've said for a long time in our industry, abstinence is not recovery. Abstinence is the absence of drug use. But what that doesn't do is tackle every part of your life that needs to be put back together after substance use. And you're right. If you're not filling the void with something else, holistic lifestyle, good relationships, relapse prevention activities, then you're a setup for failure down the road. And that's exactly to happen to one of my patients I just saw yesterday. His life was starting to fall apart after the dog. He went back and started using other drugs of abuse. Fentanyl didn't offer the alleviation, but he looked at me in the face and he said, listen, I've been taking just buprenorphine and my life had been going great until that point. I felt confident I didn't need any other therapies or treatments. I just need the drug. And the reality is that that wasn't covering his life, was it? Right? Without the social support, without psychosocial implementation, he was missing a lot more. So I would tell our audience, it is key to understand that just because you're not using the drug doesn't mean that you're a setup for long-term recovery. You need other therapies in your life to make sure that you stay on the right road.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Holly Guyer is our guest. She's written a book called Ending the Crisis, Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. Holly, can opioid cause mental health issues?
We recognize that well upwards of 50% of individuals who end up with opioid use disorder have mental health issues. Some of the biggest ones are depression. When opioids are used, they deplete your ability to make your own opioids because mm-hmm. of downregulation. And on top of that, they shoot out all your opioid receptors. Those get downregulated. And people enter profound states of depression when the drugs aren't in their system. We don't know in many patients whether depression was the cause of opioid use disorder, right? Because you can get that chemical coping phenomenon we talked about. Mm-hmm. Or if because of the crazy changes that happen in the brain, it was a natural cause of drug use. In either case, we want to treat it with counseling and in some situations, depending on the source, with medications like antidepressants.
All right, we're going to take a little break. Dr. Holly Guyer is our guest. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're going to take a break. And we'll be right back. We are back with Dr. Holly Guyer. You're listening to Real Recovery. George, what part of this show do you not want to go back and listen to a second time?
So good.
So good.
It's like listening to John Piper. I need to buy the tape, so I need to listen to
you
it
can buy
five
Holly's
times.
Book. I encourage you to do so. It's called Ending the Crisis, Opioid Addiction, and Safe opioid use. You had a question.
Actually, I had a couple, but the first one was, and things are firing on all cylinders for George F. today, where are you on using drugs to taper people, or do you believe that to get off opioids, they might have to be on a replacement drug the rest of their lives?
That is the number one question I get. And there's no doubt there is a whole lot of misunderstanding in the community about what these drugs are. The first thing that I want to preface all of this with is that when we use any medication for addiction, the purpose of using that medication is to implement it into what's called a biopsychosocial spiritual treatment paradigm. What does that mean? That essentially means treating the whole person, not just the disease. Now, when we focus on that disease component, that bio, meaning treating the biology, that neurobiology that drives addiction is going to be key, especially when it comes to opioid use disorder. The data shows in multiple studies, more than 90% of people who try doing this cold turkey without medications for opioid use disorder are going to fail miserably. They're going to be back on the drug within 1 year and typically within 3 months. But that doesn't mean it's an end-all be-all as a solution. In fact, any times it becomes the problem too. And I believe that's particularly important to understand when it comes to integrating all these other components, the psychological stuff we've talked about, right? The counseling and that holistic environment we need to put people into. And then the social component of the biopsychosocial. That social is making sure that we're helping with relapse action plans when they leave, that they've got vocational opportunities, that we're dealing with any legal issues that they need dealt with, you know, if there's criminal charges on them, getting their kids back if appropriate, if they're in a foster care system, and helping them financially and with housing. And then, of course, the spiritual components. Upwards of 84% of people that enter addiction treatment programs are asking for a spirituality integration because they know that it tackles all of those things that many people feel are so important to living. That's a spirituality for sin or shame or guilt and having a purpose and having a community to go to. So I would say, first off, understanding that's the platform we operate off. It then becomes important to understand, well, if we're going to use them, how long do we use them for? And I'd say that's very individualized. The data is showing that in many patients, there is value to long-term recovery with those medications. And I would counter that with, in many patients, there is tremendous value for looking at a tapering approach. Many people who initiate buprenorphine or methadone look so with a goal in mind of achieving recovery. And once someone's at that state of recovery, they're getting their life back, they're functional, they're holding a job, they're restoring relationships, and they've got coping mechanisms elsewhere. That is oftentimes a good opportunity to relook and say, okay, we've helped the brain recover. We've stabilized those neurotransmitter deficits. Is it time to start tapering? I can tell you as a provider, the things that I look for to say those might be good opportunities to look at tapering are for those stable patients. But the opposite is true as well. When we've got someone who's had polysubstance abuse, they're using meth, they've been on crack for years, they were using and shooting up fentanyl at the same time, their home life circumstances aren't great. They've still got disheveled appearance and their family members won't talk to them. And that person says, I'm ready to get off buprenorphine. I can tell you right off the bat, George, it's not going to end well. And the data supports that. So taking the whole picture into account, making sure that you've got a good follow-up repertoire if you are going to taper, I would say for most circumstances, 6 months is probably a minimum in the literature before we start asking that question for opioid use disorder, and oftentimes a year. But it should be renegotiated.
Great answer. Thank you. Fabulous. It makes me think, Bill, I like the what biopsychosocial approach, physical. We have to treat the whole person, and I don't think we always do that. And I always tell my guys, is it possible you're in a lot more trouble than you think you are? And I don't know about you, but over the years, and I'm still counseling guys at treatment centers, the recovery rates for opioids, I'm not seeing anything higher than 5 to 7% long term. And it's real hard to see people make it. We lost another guy last week that had 5 years, went out, you know, the reverse tolerance. They're sober for a while and they go about and take the same amount that they did the last time, and that kills them. Are you seeing better rates than that? Are you doing different things? Are you looking at new things? What excites you about that?
No, it's an interesting question. You know, one of the first things I'd say is we recognized only 10% of people with opioid use disorder ever go on medications for opioid use disorder. That is one big opportunity that we could improve someone's long-term recovery rates with. So getting them on the medication to help stabilize those neurotransmitters. And then, like I said, employing that biopsychosocial spiritual treatment. If we were doing it across the board, those numbers would change. But an interesting study came out about 2 or 3 years ago that looked across the United States as this huge cross-sectional survey. And it found that of people who struggle with substance abuse in general, 75% achieve long-term recovery. So opioids had to be in there somewhere. And those numbers, being as big as they are for opioid use disorder across America, would probably have driven up the number somewhere in there. So what I would say is, you know, let's look for opportunities to get these people into the right kind of treatment. There's a lot of differential approaches out there. Again, you're going to screen your programs for that biopsychosocial spiritual intervention, or else you're probably going to be looking at the numbers that you're quoting, George.
You know, 75%, devil's advocate here. I don't see that with people I work with. Maybe I should look at that. Maybe I should get a job doing something else. But how do you... you know, get the data, because I went to rehab 3 times and they'd call me after a year. How you doing? Well, I'd be, you know, doing an 8-ball of coke every weekend, but things are great here. How do you establish the data for a study like that?
Self-reported. There were absolutely limitations. I agree with you.
Do you think we could cut that number in half? Because you got to look at how many people you could get a hold of and what they were going to say. I just don't see that. I wish it was that, but.
You know, it's hard to get good data in any self-reporting system. And then any other mechanism to obtain the data just hasn't been employed yet to get large enough data pools to make the assumptions. So we take people's word for it. And, you know, sometimes recognizing that this is a chronic relapsing disorder, we oftentimes see people with intermittent relapses. That doesn't mean they've re-entered the lifestyle of addiction, which I think is the group you're talking about. Some people's dog dies and they do slip, but pulling them back out of it quickly and getting them into the right treatment plan is probably where many of those people are saying, listen, I'm back on the wagon. I've gotten what I've needed to get done, even though there was a slip up 6 months ago or a year for a day. That's different than the group I think you're talking about. And I can't say I've seen higher rates of that, but, you know, you might live closer to that world than I do, just being directly involved with that population all day long.
No, I get it. And I think, you know, in my world, there are no slip ups because a lot of people die from those and that ensures sobriety. But, you know, I have great respect for what you do. I was telling Bill on the break, I've been doing this 30 years. You're right up there. And I've heard you speak a few times, and I learn a lot every time. So I really want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing.
There is a lot to educate on there. And, you know, one thing that I say about that book that we put together on behalf of Mayo Clinic is that the concepts in there are the sticker on the back of a school bus. It's essentially, we stop at all railroad crossings, right? And the expectation for most of us cars is that we're going to pull up to that railroad crossing and we're going to go through it at 60 miles an hour, because clearly the train would stop for us, right? Clearly the train company knows that they should be watching the cross section. Clearly that little stick that comes down that blocks us if a train is coming is going to work. And all these assumptions that everyone else has your best interest in mind, that bus driver knows just aren't accurate 100% of the time. So that bus is prepared. And that's what information is, Bill and George. It's the patient being empowered to know that when they walk into that doctor's office and they get a bottle of pills for opioids, they know they're appropriate. They know they've been screened. They know when they should and shouldn't take them. And they know what to look for if things head south.
So good.
That is great.
Yeah. Holly, once again, thank you for bringing your wisdom and your expertise. And like George was saying, when you have been around addiction counseling like he has for so long, when somebody speaks with this kind of authority and wisdom and intelligence, you rise right to the top of the heap. And
no kidding.
Yeah, and it's really been great having you on. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, my absolute pleasure to join you guys. Look forward to doing it in the future.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Dr. Holly Guyer has been our guest. Her book is called Ending the Crisis, Mayo Clinic's Guide to Opioid Addiction and Safe Opioid Use. George, another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Now finished.
That was one of our best shows in 11 years.
Wow.
I could listen to her all day.
Yeah, she's amazing. So thank you for listening and supporting Faith Radio. We look forward to our next time when we can get together. If you missed any of this episode, please go to the podcast. Check it out. You can find that at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.